This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll take a look at the cardiac MRI and what it can tell us and how best to use it. Plus, we'll visit with a renowned cardiac surgeon to hear about the newest breakthroughs in cardiac robotic surgery. But first, in this era of exploring the human genome, what you should consider before you embark on genetic testing. Lately, it's been referred to as the Angelina effect, sparked by celebrity Angelina Jolie's recent decision to have a double mastectomy after discovering that she carried a gene that placed her at high risk for breast cancer. So in this era of available genetic testing, how should we employ this technology to our best advantage? And what are the risks of doing so? Well, here to help us with the answers to these questions is Bonnie Braddock. She's a certified genetic counselor with Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Bonnie. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's begin by explaining a little bit about genetic testing. What exactly is it?
Genetic testing is really sort of a broad way of looking at somebody's DNA, asking a specific question whether or not there's a hereditary gene that could place somebody at increased risk for certain disease.
So they look at the variations in the DNA sequencing and find genetic markers, is that correct?
They are looking for changes in the DNA that are significant, that significantly alter how the gene works, which could increase somebody's risk for developing certain types of diseases.
So why exactly would someone consider doing it? Why do it?
Somebody may consider genetic testing if it might change their chances of certain health conditions where they could choose to do certain types of screening or surveillance or monitoring to try to reduce their risk from certain health problems occurring, or trying to detect a health problem at the earliest stages before it becomes a more significant problem.
How is it actually done?
It's usually done through a blood test, and the laboratory takes that blood sample and they isolate or take out the DNA sample, and then they target a certain gene or panel of genes that are being asked to look at. And they will sequence or actually read through the gene to see if there is a significant change within the gene sequence.
So at one time, I know there's been a lot of buzz of late with the Supreme Court decision that no one company can patent a gene. I think this Myriad Genetics, there was all this buzz about their situation where they were holding that gene, some of the BRCA genes, and their testing was costing so much money because they basically had the monopoly on it. Well, that's no longer allowed, and I guess the hope now is that they'll have some competition.
I think this will be a huge impact on the field of genetic testing for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. As you said, the one laboratory had a patent on the gene, so that's the only lab that was offering testing. Soon we will have options for other laboratories doing this test, which hopefully will make the test more affordable, better access to people, and other options for how the testing is done.
Generally, is it covered by insurance?
Most insurances will provide coverage for genetic testing if there's a reason to do the testing.
So that's getting back to what I'm curious about to begin with. Do you make that decision based on something like family history? What role does, how does someone come to the decision that they want to even undertake something like this?
Absolutely. So there are certain clues in a person's health history or family history that could suggest a higher likelihood of a hereditary form of disease. When we're talking about hereditary cancer risk, general things that we think about are if somebody has a cancer diagnosis or a past history of cancer, were they diagnosed at a younger age than we typically see for that type of disease?
So that might be a flag.
Exactly.
If someone in your family or a number of people in your family contracted a disease at an earlier age.
Or if somebody had two or more occurrences of a new type of cancer.
Within the same
within
person,
within the same person. Or if there's a family history where there are multiple close relatives with the same kind of cancer or a similar type of cancer.
Now, you're talking about cancers, and obviously that's been in the news most often. But what about something like heart disease? In other words, are there tests today where if you had your an analysis done of your genes that you could determine whether you'd be a candidate for heart disease?
Yes. There are, again, certain family histories that might suggest early onset risk for cardiovascular disease, and there is some genetic testing available. So the important part to all of this is to know your family history, talk to your physician who can then guide you and determine if there's something that you should be looking into.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen along with genetic counselor Bonnie Braddock, and we're talking about genetic testing, some of the pros and cons. And when I think of the pros, obviously, in the case of Angelina Jolie being a high-profile person, they said she had a very high likelihood, something like 87 or 86% of contracting breast cancer, and then perhaps even ovarian cancer. So she made the choice at this point of having the double mastectomy. But is that generally, can they usually determine things to that high a percentage, the likelihood?
Well, right now we're looking if there is a hereditary breast cancer gene known as BRCA1 or BRCA2. What we know is we have data about the group of women who carry a change, what we call a mutation in one of these genes. And we usually give risk ranges depending on what gene it is, what data we're looking at, and what somebody's age is. So we may give somebody a different risk if they're 20 or if they're currently 60.
Yeah, I read somewhere that it's not that it only genetic testing only indicates probabilities, that aren't 100% definitive. Is that correct?
Most of the time we are looking at probabilities. There are some less common genetic conditions where it's almost inevitable for a health condition to occur. But again, those are the unusual or less common conditions. So usually we're talking about increased risk. In terms of the magnitude of risk, it depends on the gene involved and the family history.
I think what strikes me, what occurs to me immediately, though, is you can find out way ahead of perhaps the onset of disease. The question is, if there is no cure, or if there's nothing that you really can do about it. I mean, clearly, something like heart disease, you can make lifestyle changes, one would hope, dietary changes. With the BRCA genes, you can remove the potential offending organs, you know, that kind of stuff. But in something like Parkinson's, for example, or ALS, or those kinds of, you know, serious neurologic problems where there right now is no particular cure, I guess the question is, would you want to know?
Those are such personal decisions. And some people do want to know for planning, so that they can get whatever they need in order to prepare for disease, to talk to their family members, and also to potentially clarify risk to family members. On the other hand, if there's a known gene in the family and they are found not to carry it, that can certainly provide relief that they did not inherit the gene associated with the condition and therefore cannot pass it on.
What I think about here, though, how important it is, therefore, to not go this alone, not to just, obviously you can't go this alone. You have a lab and a physician to help you get this whole thing initiated, but how important, therefore, something like counseling, in your case, genetic counseling, that's your expertise, is so important because once given a probability, maybe not even a high probability that you might contract a disease for which there is no current cure, you would think you would need some counseling to help you deal with that decision.
I think that is so important. And we can look at numbers in terms of what somebody's chances of developing certain disease. But the important part is trying to put that number in the best perspective that we can in terms of what does it mean for that individual person? What is that person's option to try to reduce their risk? What are the risks to other family members? How can people talk to their relatives about this inherited condition, about this inherited risk, and what their choices might be.
How often do you see, or in your experience, and you're obviously very experienced in this, have you seen cancer associated with a hereditary gene? Obviously, the case of breast cancer and ovarian is out there.
Well, it's important to keep in mind that the great majority of cancers are not associated with a single hereditary gene. Only about 5 to 10% of all cancers, including breast cancer, are associated with a gene that we can identify. So most of the time, these genes will not explain why cancer's been in the family. That's why the family history is so important to know how to screen out which families may show a higher likelihood of finding a gene.
You know, if the tests come down in cost and if more companies make it available so it's more widely available, do you think it's the kind of thing that people should be doing almost as a prophylactic thing on a wide scale, you know, on a large scale basis? And what's your thinking about
that? We really do not recommend that, because the key thing is, how are we going to interpret results in context with somebody's personal and family history? So that might get a little tricky, and we currently don't offer just general screening for the, especially for the cancer genes.
I know we don't offer it, but I'm just kind of, you know, kind of blue skying and thinking down the road, is this something that may occur? Tell me, we have a little bit of time left, what actually happens? How do you get into the picture as a genetic counselor? How does someone come to you?
Many physicians will refer patients after they screen their own patients for their family history. Some patients call us directly that they've heard about us and they're concerned about something in their family. Sometimes we've seen a family member where we've identified a genetic risk and they pass that word on to other relatives. So we wind up seeing multiple family members.
So you'll first get the results of the testing, and then with that in hand, you'll sit down with the family and discuss probabilities and what needs to be done.
We meet with people even before we embark on genetic testing to determine how likely is it that there's a hereditary gene.
Or even if
gene,
they should.
Or even, right, how likely is it that we'll find something, what that might mean for somebody, depending on how the test results come back, all of the benefits and drawbacks of genetic testing. If somebody does decide to go ahead with testing, then we do meet with them once the test results come back to talk about what those results mean for them.
Well, I can see in some, it's really, if you're in doubt, you must get help from a professional genetic counselor and not this idea of somehow doing it yourself, especially if the tests do become increasingly available. Well, thanks so much for coming in. My guest has been Bonnie Braddock. She's a certified genetic counselor with Upstate Medical University. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Coming up next, what is the cardiac MRI, and how can it best be used to save lives? I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Well, here with me for our Healthy Eats segment is our own Upstate dietitian, Terry Podolak. Hey, Terry, welcome.
Hi, Linda. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you know, you have something to share with us, a very special book.
I do. This is one of my favorite books. It's called The Jungle Effect, and you know, with all the confusion today about what we should eat and not eat, this is a wonderful book that I think everyone should try to read or get a copy of. The person that wrote the book is a physician out of San Francisco, and she had a patient of hers who was just struggling and struggling with weight loss, like so many of our patients do. But she noticed when her patient went to her homeland in Brazil, she lost weight. And then when she came back to San Francisco, where she was working, the weight came back on. So this physician, Daphne, decided to take 3 years of her life, and she actually went to different parts of our country, our world, to look to see where there's less disease.
So this is Dr. Daphne Miller.
Yeah.
And she was an internist?
Yeah. A regular internist.
Okay. Yep, and so she traveled. Where did she go?
Well, one of the first places she went to was Brazil. She actually did some volunteer work there. You know, again, just the place where that patient had lost all the weight. And she said, oh, my goodness, just looking around, there's no obesity, there's no diabetes, there's no heart disease. You know, there's some standard, injuries from living in that environment, but none of the chronic American diseases that we see.
So what did she surmise from all of that?
And just, it's definitely our standard American diet, which we call SAD, S-A-D. So our American diet is sad. There are so many processed foods. We're all drinking too much soda. We're not eating enough fruits and vegetables. We're confused about what breads and grains to buy.
I think we're all confused in general. Every day we hear information about what to eat and what not to eat, yeah. And sometimes it's the same thing.
And nutrition should not be stressful, and then we're getting all stressed about what to eat. So we really need to learn to enjoy our foods and not be stressed about what to eat. So
what is the jungle effect exactly then?
Well, that was in part of Brazil where there was a jungle. And again, the effect was just how when Daphne or Dr. Miller saw people eating their local seasonal food there, no soda, very little processed food, anything. Everything was grown and eaten right there.
So there weren't a lot of preservatives. There weren't a lot of extra chemicals that you can't even recognize the names of.
Exactly.
Everything was basically fresh,
exactly.
Local, and
And when people ate, too, yes, they ate in a relaxed environment. They ate together and dined together, and they ate slowly. One of my favorite things that Dr. Miller said is she went to Iceland, and she must have been extra hungry, and it was eating very fast. And they said to her, Dr. Miller, Siggy, Siggy, and that means slow, slow. So as Americans, too, we're all running and eating much too fast.
So
we need to really slow down.
So this wasn't just the ingredients. It was also lifestyle.
Exactly.
It was also the way they approach food.
Exactly. She immersed herself right into the cultures, which for some, is very difficult. So she looked at Iceland. It was so interesting where it's dark and there's not a lot of vegetables there. But the animals there ate the grass and the mosses, which are very high in omega-3s. So they related, a lot of omega-3s to decreased depression.
Wow. So the bottom line was she was saying that these people who eat communally, that eat indigenous kinds of diet,
yes,
rather
exactly.
than things that are brought from very far away, things that are seasonal, all of that, generally they had better health.
Yes,
so
exactly.
What exactly is the bottom line? What is she then suggesting for us?
Right. So what do we do here in the United States and back in San Francisco? She said to just eat a variety from different countries. But get these foods, if we can, that are still local, seasonable. Maybe have your own gardens. Again, eat in a happy, relaxed environment. Slow down and eat like the Japanese. Eat till you're 80% full. Don't eat till you're so over full. And that was her main message. No stress, but just to try to eat less processed. And
was she also suggesting that you should eat a diet that matches your own ancestry? In other words,
no, because a lot of us are very mixed ancestry, you would think.
Yeah.
But again, just really what matches your taste buds too.
Mm-hmm. So overall, do you recommend this type of book to your patients?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And just the recommendations that are within the book, and to be adventurous and to try new things and recipes, and for all of us, really try to cook more at home and to slow down.
Sounds like great advice. I want to thank you so much. My guest has been Terry Podolak. She is our own upstate dietitian, and this has been our Healthy Eat segment. Thanks, Terry.
Thank you, Linda.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. With so many advances in digital imaging these days, doctors have more assistance than ever in diagnosing and finding the cause of a patient's problem. Well, here with me this morning with more of the inside story about cardiac imaging is Dr. Ali Sala. He's an assistant professor of medicine and the director of cardiac imaging at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Sala. Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about cardiac imaging these days. I mean, what is new and what's going on?
A lot has been done in the field of cardiovascular imaging in the past decade. One thing which stands out is cardiovascular MRI, which is really the most advanced and the newest technology in the field of cardiovascular imaging. This technology enables us to study the heart in such detail, which was impossible, before its establishment. So the advent of cardiac MRI has really helped us identify causes of heart problems which we wouldn't otherwise in regular imaging modalities.
Very interesting. So how is it the same or how is it different from a regular MRI, for example?
So that's a good question. Some patients underwent MRI of the brain, for example, or MRI of the abdomen, which has been around for many decades now. The heart MRI is unique because, as you know, the heart is always beating. It's in motion. So it's extremely difficult to image something which is in motion because of the motion artifact. But technology has enabled us to freeze, so to speak, the heart in space and time and get really excellent pictures of the heart by using magnetic resonance imaging.
That's very interesting. It sounds to me that the little bit I know, for example, of video versus still photography, that if you take a video of something, you should be able to slice out various still images from that. Is that somewhat of what you're doing with cardiac MRI?
Somewhat similar, yeah. During the cardiac cycle, there is a time where the heart actually doesn't do much, doesn't beat. So we take those times and image the heart and reconstruct the entire image to make sense for us.
So you put the pieces of the puzzle together. That way. How is it different from a CAT scan?
CT scan is completely different from MRI. One, CAT scan uses radiation to generate imaging. Magnetic resonance imaging does not use radiation. Rather, it uses radio frequency energy to generate an image. Two, with cardiac MRI, we are able to image the heart as it beats. So you have a real-time dynamic information. CAT scan gives you a static pictures, not dynamic pictures. So as the heart is a beating organ, you need to have more dynamic information. So the heart MRI is superior in that
regard. It sounds like it would be much superior. And then also you have the downside of the radiation emitted during CAT scan, which has some potential problem attached to it. Well, it's very, very exciting. So is this brand new? And is Upstate one of the few places that has it? Tell us about that.
Yeah, cardiac MRI is a cutting-edge technology, which really came into picture in the last 6-7 years. There are a handful of places in the state of New York which have this imaging modality, and Upstate is one of them. We are unique in the region to provide this service. The program at Upstate has the ability to do a complete cardiovascular MRI examination. And also, it's staffed with a cardiologist who has an expertise in the field of cardiovascular imaging. So these make it a unique cardiac MRI program in central New York.
And you find things like the causes of a heart failure or whatever the diseases are that are affecting the heart, but you can also diagnose masses, I read somewhere, and other abnormalities of the pulmonary veins, things that extensive.
Exactly. So cardiac MRI is used for a variety of diseases affecting the cardiovascular system. I cannot list all of them within such a short time, but I can give you the highlight. Patients who have heart failure were able to tell the exact cause.
Wow.
And also if they have any chance for recovery from heart failure. So that's important. Patients who have cardiac masses, by echo or ultrasound, you're not able to tell if that is a blood clot, a thrombus, or a tumor. We have the ability exactly to differentiate what it is by a cardiac MRI.
Wow.
And patients who have serious arrhythmias, which can lead to death sometimes, by doing a cardiac MRI, we're able to tell the focus of that serious arrhythmia and come up with a proper treatment for the patient.
So you really affect morbidity and mortality. I mean, you really can extend a person's life.
Absolutely.
By understanding the actual causation and then develop a treatment appropriate.
Exactly.
Amazing. So how did you acquire this expertise? I understand something that struck me in preparing for the interview, that this is not a radiology subspecialty the way other imaging tests are. In other words, to be trained for this, you have to have a different background. What's your background?
So I did my cardiology fellowship at the University of Kentucky in Lexington, Kentucky. The Kentucky Heart Center at the university had a good cardiac MRI program, and the director over there was able to image the heart, which you wouldn't in any other imaging, so that really made the influence on me to pursue this career. And what he does affects the patient's life in a positive way. And I wanted to pursue that subspecialty.
So then you went on to SUNY Stony Brook, I understand, and then finally Georgetown?
Yeah, so while I was at University of Kentucky, I went to Georgetown for several months to study cardiac MRI. And then I had the opportunity to do a cardiac MRI fellowship, a dedicated fellowship at Stony Brook. And I completed a year at Stony Brook in addition to what I have done in Georgetown as well.
It's a lot of studying. So just in the little bit of time we have left, what do you imagine, what advances in imaging do you imagine over the next 5 years or that are in the pipeline currently?
I think the next decade is crucial in advanced cardiovascular imaging because a lot of research is going on at this time. What I see common, which impacts the practice of cardiology, is interventional cardiac MRI, where we're able to do a cardiac intervention using MRI images instead of X-rays.
So you'll actually be able to do guided. The MRI will guide you to doing intervention.
Exactly.
Minimally invasive interventions into the heart.
Exactly.
Amazing. Well, it's very, very exciting. Would you advise medical students to go into this kind of a career?
Absolutely. This is an area where it's highly advancing. It has so much impact on the patient's morbidity and mortality. You impact patients' life in a positive way. So for the students who have planned to do cardiology, this is one subspecialty they should entertain.
Sounds fantastic. Well, my guest has been Dr. Ali Saleh. He's assistant professor of medicine and the director of the cardiac imaging program at Upstate Medical University. Next, we'll hear all about the latest breakthrough in cardiac robotic surgery. And be sure to stay with us for our visit with the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
I'm Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for July 15th. This week's tip is sweat your stress away. The rush of anxiety and pent-up energy that can result from stress is part of your body's natural defense mechanisms. While the desire to flight or flee is helpful in emergencies, too much of this tension can negatively impact your health. Instead of bottling it up, get it out with exercise. Releasing excess energy with physical activity is a healthy way to alleviate built-up muscle tension and other symptoms. This week, after a tightly scheduled day of meetings, exams, or errands, get active and aim for moderately intensive exercise. It may seem counterintuitive, but moving more will help you relax. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Breakthroughs in medical technology have extended life and improved life quality profoundly in recent decades. Most noteworthy in the field of surgery, minimally invasive procedures, guided by tiny scopes or with the assistance of robots, have transformed many open surgical procedures, resulting in smaller scars, less blood loss, and postoperative pain, as well as faster recovery and shortened hospital stays. But the question remains, how do all these breakthroughs affect outcomes? And what does it mean for the future? Well, to answer these questions, we are most fortunate to have with us this morning Dr. Randolph Chitwood, an esteemed expert in minimally invasive surgery. With a distinguished career in the field of cardiothoracic surgery, he has special expertise in complex valvular surgery, including mitral repair, as well as aortic valve and cardiac rhythm surgery, and is now Senior Associate Vice Chancellor for Health Affairs and the Director of the East Carolina Heart Institute, as well as the Chief of the Division of Cardiothoracic and Vascular Surgery. Welcome, Dr. Chitwood.
It's great to be in Syracuse.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. So for the benefit of our listeners, can you briefly explain how the term minimally invasive applies to what you do?
Minimally invasive has really two connotations. One is, some people would say, is not using the heart-lung machine. But the way I generally think of minimally invasive is tiny incisions, working through small ports to do the standard operations that we do in the past through a breastbone incision. It's better for the patient. And heretofore, it was tougher for the surgeon. But today, with some of the new technology, it's much better than it was in the past, even through a full sternotomy incision.
It seems amazing to me, actually, that you can actually perform these kinds of complex surgical procedures with a tiny keyhole incision. Is this something you could have dreamt of, let's say 20 years ago?
Well, in North Carolina, I can see people on television in New York City.
Yes, true.
Okay. Therefore, if you can go through a chest wall with a small incision and see just as well on the other side as you do through a big incision, you can do the operation just as well.
That's a great point.
So the new technology has been developed to allow access. There's nothing robotic about this. It's not R2-D2 or C-3PO or Will Robinson. It is a device that allows access. It allows you to have excellent vision and excellent ergonomic access to all parts of the heart.
For the benefit of our listeners, and actually for my benefit as well, can you help clarify some terminology? I hear bandied about all the time the term with regard to minimally invasive, laparoscopic, and then I hear endoscopic. Can you clarify what those mean and how they're different?
Well, really, the root name is endoscopic. It means a scope, a vision inside, whereas laparoscopic relates to the abdomen. Lapar in Latin means abdomen.
I see.
Or arthroscopic, which is related to the joints.
I see. So it has to do with what part of the body the scope is addressing, so to speak.
Yes, that's right. Or thoracoscopic.
A thoracoscopic is what you do, basically, mm-hmm. The thorax and the cardiac area. But all of those are all considered minimally invasive, is that correct?
They're all minimally invasive.
Right. Right. So where does the robot fit into all of this?
Well, the robot is basically a device that allows you to telemanipulate from a station And it was the surgeon's motions, the exact motions they make with the instruments, and to emulate this inside the chest, inside the heart. So when I take a stitch in this fashion, it's replicated completely inside the heart, except there's no tremor. And your visualization is better because it's 10x magnification.
So it's expanding the capabilities that
it's
you would
have. It's expanding the capabilities, and you have three-dimensional vision.
Now, one thing I guess I'm a little unclear about is if you were, is it a little bit like, just for, again, for the benefit of our listeners, is it a little bit like using like a Wii, you know, this toy that they use when they pretend they're playing tennis on a screen and they move their arms and you see it on the screen?
Well, no, not really, because you're actually seeing direct vision, just as if you're looking through binoculars.
And your movements at this station
are emulated completely.
Like a joystick, almost.
Well, kind of like a joystick, but much more accurate.
Right. So what do you consider the benefits from all of your experience with that, if you were to just generalize to say what the benefits are?
I think the benefits are clearly cosmesis. Small incision is not as ugly. Much faster recovery.
You can get less blood loss, perhaps?
Less blood loss. You can get back to work within a couple of weeks. Less blood loss, less time on the ventilator. And so 10 years from now, there's no difference whether you had minimally invasive or a full sternotomy. But in the immediate recovery period, there is a difference.
And basically faster recovery, as you said. Are there complications less or more from doing an open procedure versus this, or is there no difference?
Well, bleeding is certainly less. The complications are dependent today mostly on the patient's comorbidities.
Meaning what pre-existing conditions they may have had?
If they've had strokes before, whatever. And some of those patients will not qualify for a minimally invasive operation, because in those patients, it's safer to do it through a traditional procedure. So in the cohort of patients, the individuals that undergo the robotic surgery, they're pretty straightforward patients. They just have one problem, a leaky mitral valve. Generally, they're younger patients, 55 to 60, and don't have a lot of other medical problems.
And they lend themselves, therefore, to this kind of approach. But in terms of the long-term outcomes, basically, they're the same as to whether you do an open procedure or a minimally invasive procedure. Is that correct?
Yeah, the results for mitral valve repair are the same. In other words, we tried to get, first you have to get as good results or better results than with a standard technique. So we're out far enough now to know that our quality of operations are parallel to those of a full sternotomy through the breastbone and traditional surgery.
Okay, well, I understand that you've done some very, very extraordinary pioneering work, that you were the first the person to perform the first robotic heart operation in 10 different countries. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's a very interesting thing. We first did things in the United States and through FDA protocols to get the device approved. Then in Thailand, England, a whole bunch of different countries, Italy, we mentored people and taught them how to do these operations. And basically, we did the first one in India, Thailand. It's fascinating because you'd say, well, gosh, you're going to go to India. Well, I went in the Escorts Heart Institute, and it had nicer equipment than we had at home.
Oh, my goodness, really?
So, you
that's
know,
a shocker.
Well, in Thailand, it was basically a German operating room.
Oh.
And so, you know, I was operating just recently in Paraguay, and the hospital was old and looked like a really, you know, not well-kept place. But the operating room is totally modern with the same echo stuff that we have here. And so you see in a lot of these places, they do have maybe not as many great places, but they have some good places that the technology is being used.
It's interesting because we do get parochial in this country where we think we're the only ones who have everything.
Right.
But clearly it's not the case. So that you actually were the principal investigator, you just alluded to that, for the robotic mitral valve trials for the FDA?
Right.
So that you were engaged in figuring out whether, in fact, this was going to be an effective procedure.
The first studies are done as a safety and efficacy. In other words, is it as safe, is it as good as a standard technique? We operated on 20 patients, presented that to the FDA, and of course we informed the patients completely. that if we had trouble with the robot, that we would do it either via traditional method.
You always had that as a fallback.
Yeah, and they always, and I must say, they were pioneers because basically they wanted a small incision if we could do it, but were willing to accept traditional surgery if we couldn't do it. And none of those patients did we have to convert to a traditional operation, and no mortalities and no major complications.
It's wonderful.
So then you go back and say, can this be done just not at your place, but at different places? So we selected 10 centers from across the country, and we did a multi-center study. Then we collected that data, and we were able to replicate this at other institutions. Based on that, it was approved for general use in thoracic surgery.
So basically, that's become state-of-the-art.
Yes.
It sounds like. Are there any disadvantages?
Well, some will say cost is a disadvantage. These devices now are upwards of $1.5 million to $2 million. But I tell folks, okay, CT scanner is expensive, but it's the standard of care to use these devices. So what you have to do, if you're just doing cardiac surgery, you won't use it enough. So you have to have a robotic users group. For example, in urology, over 65% of the prostatectomies are now done using robotics. And in GYN surgery, over 50% of the endoscopic stuff is being done using robotics. ENT surgery, so you develop a robotics user group so that this is a shared resource for the institution. And that's the way you take care of the cost issue.
Are there, go ahead.
Also team training. It's a team sport. You really have to have a team. And basically, they have to be well-trained. They think the robot's going to make them a better surgeon. It won't make you a better surgeon. It'll make you the same surgeon, but allow you access in small places. So you really have to understand that concept. This is not going to take a mediocre doctor and make them fantastic. But it will take a talented surgeon to that next level of being able to access through small incisions.
Are there any downsides to the use of the robot? I mean, you've done it both ways, obviously. You've trained initially without the robot. How about like hand-eye coordination, the issue of kinesthetic feedback, the touch, all those things? I mean, because it seems like it must be a major adjustment to go from your hands in the body to being at a little console making those things happen.
Well, when people enter this area now, they're working with a third-generation device. So let's roll the clock back to 2000, the year 2000, when we had a first-generation device. The vision wasn't as good. The ergonomics, what I mean by that, the hand-eye motion wasn't as good. And there was a learning curve. There's no question about it. So we practiced and practiced and practiced. It's like, you know, the 10,000-hour theory. If you practice for 10,000 hours, you're going to be pretty good. So we were able to... The instrument exchanges were difficult. It was more difficult. But as we evolved, the devices we have now, you don't need tactile feedback. You have ocular feedback from your eyes, which is 80% of your sensory input. You have excellent ergonomics. The assistants can exchange the instruments very rapidly, and so it's decreased the operative time. And the visualization is fantastic. It's three-dimensional, high definition, magnified, with good color rendition. And so basically, you know, it's a different ball game today. So now as we roll it out in these different areas, the individuals now that are using these newer devices don't have to experience the early years.
Is the training as long?
No, the training's shorter. I mean, basically, I insist on having an experienced surgical group to train, not novices or residents. And so they come with the attitude of, we have a nurse, a first assistant, an anesthesiologist, a heart-lung machine person, and a surgeon. And they train on the system first, just to learn how to work the system and to troubleshoot and handle all those things. Then they learn at a different setting on specific operations, one at a time, whether it's valves, coronaries. We also train in urology. We train all the way across. Even though I'm a cardiac surgeon, our laboratory is set up to train cross-specialty. And so generally a well-organized team, when they come for the first week and have system training, and then come at a later time for mitral training, they can usually go back and perform that operation almost as well as we can. We always send a mentor, a surgeon mentor, out either to Japan or whatever to for their first cases.
Amazing. Do you think that, do you expect that all heart surgeries will eventually become minimally invasive, or are there some patients, like you alluded to earlier, that are not good candidates?
Well, we know that patients with severe pulmonary disease, lung disease, don't do well if you go through the chest and maybe because of potential injuring the phrenic nerve, which is the motor nerve for the diaphragm, and they probably do better through a sternotomy. I think that we've even modified our sternotomy. We may make the same size incision in the bone, but we don't spread the ribs as much. Also, there are certain operations that are just not amenable to robotics because they're problems on different parts of the heart, and so you have a geographic location problem. You've got two coronaries over here, and you've got a valve over here. Also, a lot of, you know, like aortic arch stuff, where they basically have to replace the ascending aorta from an aneurysm, that won't be amenable to this.
So what do you see as in new advances in the robot coming down the pike? What kinds of changes? You said there's been so much transformation since 2000. What new things are coming down the pike?
Well, one thing we have is the new things are trainers, which are basically electronic modules, very much like the kids play with games, that have a certain set of tasks. And there are metrics that actually measure how well you do those tasks. And it's kind of daunting when an experienced person like me sits down in one of these, you know, relatively, quote, simple things, and your score is not as high as you would think.
Okay? Yes, I can
And so relate. You work with this a little bit, and your scores are better. And so that kind of simulation training is where we're going. The other thing is image-guided surgery. In other words, by using echocardiography to plan operations, because we're operating on the heart when it's stopped. So to plan the operation is based on the pathology of a heart that's beating. And we measure everything, and now we know like a pattern, like mother used to make dresses. Not many mothers do anymore. But you put a pattern over the valve, and it's sort of like cut here, stitch here. And the other thing that will come is I think in time you'll have CT scanning that will be integrated with these devices to say essentially drill here. In other words, rather than making an incision and taking a peek in and directing it with vision where you put these arms, it'll say with laser-guided accuracy, you'll come right at the mitral valve if you go in this spot and this spot.
Amazing. Well, the technology clearly is making the difference, but it's got to be in hands like yours, experienced, well-trained, and as you said, it's not going to make a phenomenal surgeon out of a mediocre one. Well, Dr. Randolph Chitwood, esteemed cardiothoracic surgeon and pioneer in the field of robotic minimally invasive surgery and director of the East Carolina Heart Institute, thanks so much for sharing some time with us today. I know you have a very busy schedule, but we really appreciate your coming in.
Hello, this is Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate's Literary Journal, with this week's offering from The Healing Muse. The Healing Muse is often dedicated to our founding editor, Bonnie St. Andrews. She was a poet whom we lost way too soon to a glioblastoma. One of the poems that she wrote that I love that's perfect for a summer season is called Opening the Summer House. Sun-drenched again and one with the universe, I am sweeping this kitchen, singing at the top and bottom of essentially tuneless lungs. On the porch, I contemplate a cormorant, precariously balanced atop sails, wings outstretched, frail as a purple Jesus, steadying for nails. Being neither bird nor sacred boy, I tremble in joy, if not redemption, and scrub down doomsday thoughts and dogmas of denial. For a precious fortnight, sin itself is not on trial. In beguiling heat, I perceive myself a deity, and so decree, humans need atone for nothing. Cardinal-hatted hollyhocks agree. My life plies with waves that leap like ballerinas on the jetty, spinning diaphanous skirts of foam. Gull, cod, cloud, plover, everything dances or hovers. Crescendo, decrescendo, Triton blasts sea symphonies against stone. Sunbeams clap topaz hands while girls plant shells like dreams in amber sands. I am planting too. Come high tide and harvest moon, love itself may slide inside my cave of dreams, mystic and wild as a silky. Alive with light, I am pounded thin as a compact disc by sound. I am a silver filament humming in the August heat, a one-woman network of good news. All my links and lines are open. When I take the airwaves, Mother Nature has her say. Pipers promise yes, south winds murmur stay.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we examine the dental issues that cancer patients can face. Plus, in our What's Your Emergency segment, how seasonal changes can precipitate real breathing problems. If you want to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. And if you missed any of today's show, you can find a podcast of it on our website, healthlinkonair.org. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and Becky Sirio, produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.